Okay, folks, let's reconvene, please. So, Mr. Robertson, could you introduce item 9?
Yes. Item 9 is the Active Oil Field Regulatory Program Update, specifically regarding the aquifer exemption process. Item 9 is an information item and requires no board action. At the March 2016 board meeting, Active Oil Field staff presented an overview of the program and the broader portfolio of oil field related regulatory work in which they were then engaged. Stepping forward a year in time, the same staff led by Matthew Keeling, sitting behind me, will present an overview of the aquifer exemption and Class 2 underground injection control, or you'll hear the term UIC, work that has become the primary focus of the program now. Matt will provide an update on implementation of the Federal Safe Drinking Water Act, the aquifer exemption review process, and associated coordination with the State Water Board and Dogger on this process, and then progress and challenges working through aquifer exemptions. And then I also want to acknowledge that Pat Abel, the Dogger Coastal District Deputy, will also provide some information regarding Dogger's lead role in the aquifer exemption process. And then both will be available for questions. And with that, I'll hand it over to Pat.
There we go. Mr. Chair, members of the board, as John Robertson said, my name is Matthew Keeling, and I am the program manager for our Active Oil Field Regulatory Program. Today, I'm just going to give you a high-level programmatic overview of our coordinated technical advisory role with the State Water Board for the review of aquifer exemption applications associated with the Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, affectionately known as Dogger. And I'll refer to them as Dogger throughout the rest of the presentation. And this is for the implementation of the Class 2 UIC program. And for the sake of timing, I'm going to skip through some portions of my presentation here because it's getting a little bit late. So in my presentation overview, I'm just going to start with a little background on the UIC program and our new role, followed by a general discussion of the aquifer exemption application criteria that we're using. The review process and agency roles, an overview of the applications we received along with some of the challenges we encountered, followed by a quick summary. One of the things I wanted to make certain is that we're not going to be talking about any individual aquifer exemption applications or projects, given the uncertainty with respect to the ongoing review process. And also, these are quite complex applications, and we could spend an hour or more just briefing you on one of them. So as you may recall from our big picture discussion last March, the Regional Water Board is mandated to act in a technical advisory role in coordination with Dogger for the review of the aquifer exemption applications to ensure that they meet applicable state and federal criteria. Now, before Dogger can forward an aquifer exemption application to EPA for review, the State Water Board needs to provide written concurrence that these applications meet applicable state and federal criteria. And our current efforts are focused on reviewing aquifer exemption applications that address underground injection control wells, or UIC wells, that were previously permitted in areas without an EPA-approved aquifer exemption. And this includes about 47 disposal wells and a large number of enhanced oil recovery wells, that if they don't get an aquifer exemption for the formation for which they're injecting into, they'll have to cease operating. Now, the regulatory approval for Class 2 injection is essentially a 2 or 3 step process. First, Dogger issues a permit to drill and construct an oil field well and applies various conditions depending on the type and intended use of that well. Dogger can also issue permits to convert a well, say from a oil production well to an injection well. Now, prior to allowing ejection, either an EPA-approved aquifer exemption is required for the zone that they're proposing to eject into, or a determination is made by Dogger that the injection zone is not an underground source of drinking water. Now, this determination is based on water quality data showing that the injection zone formation water contains greater than 10,000 milligrams per liter total dissolved solids and is currently not serving as a source of drinking water. Now, once one of these two criteria are met, an oil field operator can apply for an injection project permit for individual or multiple wells. Now, the criteria that we're using are contained within the Code of Federal Regulations and the California Public Resource Code. Now, the federal criteria are primarily focused on protecting sources of drinking water with an emphasis on public water systems. Now, as amended by Senate Bill 83 that was adopted in 2015, California Public Resources Code includes additional criteria associated with ensuring the injected fluids are contained within the exempted area and the protection of all beneficial uses of groundwater, not just drinking water. SB 83 also established programmatic requirements for the implementation of a public comment and hearing process and reporting to the legislature. And this is a requirement for Dogger that we also participate in tangentially. In addition to the state federal criteria, we're also using various guidance documents and checklists as we've outlined in the staff report when we're doing our review of these applications. Now, I'm not going to discuss the criteria in any given detail because they're included within the staff report. In simplified terms, the criteria that need to be met are that the aquifer is not currently a source of drinking water, so that's the first one. The second is the aquifer is unlikely to be a future source of drinking water for various reasons as outlined within the criteria. Three, the injected fluids must not impact current or potential future beneficial uses, and again, this is not just drinking water that we're addressing. And four, the injected fluids must remain in the exempted area, both laterally and vertically. So as a lead agency, Dogger receives the application from the oil field operator and conducts an initial review before providing to the water board for our review. This step typically includes a Dogger briefing to the water board before we get the application to kind of prepare us for it. Now, once we get the application, the State and Regional Water Board technical staff conduct coordinated review of the application and request additional information from Dogger as needed to complete the review and ensure it complies with the criteria. Now, Central Coast Water Board staff conduct a series of internal briefings to inform management and ultimately generate formal technical memorandums that we send to State Board containing our questions and any recommendations we may have for conditions. And then they forward them on to Dogger along with their comments. And this step may entail several iterations of comment and responses. Once our questions are addressed by the oil field operator in coordination with Dogger, and the application is revised as needed to validate compliance with the criteria, the State Board drafts a preliminary concurrence letter in coordination with us. And issues it to Dogger, and this triggers the public comment and hearing process. Now, after the public hearing, Dogger compiles and addresses all the comments, and they coordinate with us as needed to address any specific issues or questions that are more in our wheelhouse. And the next step, if no significant issues are raised during the public process that warrant revision or denial of the application, the State Water Board issues a final concurrence letter, and the application is then submitted to EPA for their review. So as has been consistent with the Aurora Grande oil field aquifer exemption, EPA typically has questions, and there's a back and forth review and response to comment between EPA and Dogger, and we're typically involved in those discussions and whatever briefings that happen. So at any point in this process, the application can be sent back to a previous step for revision, or it can be denied. Now, our coordinated review of the offer exemption applications is part of a broader effort and mandate to bring the state's implementation of the UIC program back into compliance. As you may recall from our March meeting update last year, we issued 12 orders to oil field operators requesting technical information for 47 disposal wells. This effort was intended to determine whether or not any of those wells posed immediate threats to drinking water supply wells. Now, although none of these injection wells were shown to pose a threat, three of the wells were determined to be within existing EPA-approved aquifer exemption areas, and also five were determined to be injecting into formations that were not considered to be a source of drinking water supply per that greater than 10,000 milligram per liter total dissolved solids concentration threshold. And we're still in the process of validating the water quality data for those five wells to ensure that that is indeed the case. Now, it's anticipated that we'll be reviewing existing and new UIC projects as part of our ongoing coordination with the State Board and DOGGR as we move forward. So our review of these aquifer exemption applications is just a component of this process. This table is a general overview of the number and status of the aquifer exemptions statewide and within our region. And as you can see, the number of aquifer exemption applications in our region is a small subset of the overall number statewide. And most of them are within the Central Valley, within Region 5. So thus far, we've received 8 applications for our region. Review is ongoing for 6 of these, and 2 have received preliminary concurrence from State Board in coordination with us. Of these 2 applications that we've received, that have received Water Board concurrence, one is currently under review by EPA, that's for the Aurora Grande oil field, and one is subject to a pending meeting as required prior to submitting it to EPA, and that's for the San Arno oil field in Monterey County. And there are still 3 anticipated applications that are pending. Now, although none of the applications we've received so far have warranted an outright denial, as would be warranted, for example, if the targeted zone is being utilized for water supply, State Water Board is considering partial concurrence on some of the applications where they don't completely meet the criteria. And this is a fairly recent shift in the process to ensure that we're keeping these applications moving.
Okay. I'm sorry, can you explain what partial concurrence means?
So the applications generally request an exemption for a defined area, both laterally and vertically. And if through our review, a portion of that application request meets the criteria, but another portion does not, what we're looking at is separating them out and say, we'll give you an exemption for this area, but not this area. In some cases, they're looking at conditioning certain types of injection within certain areas, and that's another way to look at it. So I'm going to put out a couple of corrections and an update that's on the table at page 7 of the staff report. Now, there are 2 incorrect dates for the, let's see if I got a pointer, here we go, for the San Arno and McCool Ranch light item. There were some incorrect year dates here, so we had to update these from 2015-2016, seeing here the pending public hearing date is in 2017, not 2016. Also, I wanted to point out that we now have a pending preliminary concurrence letter for one of the Lynch Canyon aquifer exemptions here, so just clarifying this for the record. And the applications are large documents, often several hundred pages or more in length, and include numerous appendices with really complex geologic and hydrologic information. and often this complexity results in various levels of uncertainty regarding compliance with applicable criteria. And this is particularly the case for containment of injected fluids, and I'll touch on this a little bit more in subsequent slides. Now, in addition to the information contained in the applications, our staff are also reviewing all other available information and data that we have to corroborate the information that's being provided in the applications. I'd have to say our technical staff are doing a bang-up job picking these applications apart, identifying the uncertainties, asking the hard questions, and in many cases coming up with recommendations for conditions that should be applied down the road at the project level. And we're documenting all of this in technical memorandums that as I previously mentioned, that we're preparing and submitting to State Board and ultimately going to DOGGR. So we're creating a historical record of the work that we're doing. These figures here is just kind of to convey to you the types of information and the complexity that we're looking at here. Now, there are a number of challenges that we're encountering as part of the review process. I'm just going to touch on, I think, the two most significant challenges, and I'll let the staff report speak to itself for the sake of time here. But the first one is that the water quality data that are included in these applications are often old and lack supporting documentation is needed to validate the quality of the data and the representativeness of it. All of the data have been compromised by oil field-related activities, such as the use of concentrated brine solutions that are often used to stabilize the wellbore when they're drilling the well, or to protect the well after it's been installed and it's sitting idle before they actually use it. These issues with the water quality data also call into question the validity of some of the UIC projects that have been permitted in areas that have been determined to be to not be underground sources of drinking water based on that 10,000 milligram per liter total dissolved solids criteria. And this is something that we hope to address in the future as we start looking at these to ensure that they are, in fact, not underground sources of drinking water. The other primary challenge that we have is that the applications typically use a combination of geologic and hydraulic information to validate the containment criteria. Definitively validating the containment criteria can be difficult because structural containment may not exist or be poorly defined in some areas, and hydraulic containment is dependent on the number, location, and operation of injection and extraction wells, which change over time. So we can't necessarily hang our hats on a hydraulic argument today when operational changes in the future may be completely different and the gradients may change within the injection zones. Consequently, containment may only be partially validated at the aquifer exemption application review level, and this is kind of what we're struggling with. And what needs to happen is that this containment criteria evaluation needs to be carried forward to the project review level to ensure that, you know, we can achieve containment or compliance with the containment criteria. So I think, as I mentioned before, the application we've reviewed thus far for our region, none have really warranted an outright denial. In most cases, we're relying on multiple lines of evidence in support of the application meeting applicable criteria. The lines of evidence generally consist of a combination of structural, physical, and hydraulic containment, as we just talked about a little bit. The injection zones are typically deep formations with significant lateral and vertical separation from shallower water supply aquifers and beneficial use wells. And the oil fields are typically located in rural areas where you don't have a lot of development or potential beneficial use receptor wells that could be at risk. And there's a few exceptions to this in our region. Now, one of the key outcomes of our review of the aquifer exemption applications is the need to conduct more focused containment reviews at the project level and to apply operational conditions or monitoring requirements as necessary to ensure and document compliance with the containment criteria. Now, although there are some limitations associated with our advisory role in the exemption application review process, our technical reviews result and an unprecedented level of water quality oversight for the state's implementation of the UIC program. Our goal is to provide the highest level of technical review possible to ensure the applications are consistent with applicable state and federal criteria, and to ultimately ensure the protection of water quality and beneficial uses. So we're committed to our ongoing coordination with State Board and DAUGR, with a focus on providing an additional layer of accountability and transparency regarding technical uncertainties or challenges. And this is particularly true with respect to the containment criteria and the need to ensure compliance in the future. And it's anticipated that we will be reviewing UIC projects and have an opportunity to conduct more robust containment analyses to ensure ongoing compliance with the containment criteria. So I think moving forward, it's imperative that we kind of follow this thread and ensure compliance with the criteria. So with that, if you have any questions.
And you're also going to have Pat give a presentation, right?
Yeah, so come up if you'd like to do that now. Talk.
If I would like to, because that way we have a full scope of presentation. Thank you very much.
Chairman Wolf and members of the board, thank you for having me here today. My name is Pat Abel. I represent the State of California's Department of Conservation, Division of Oil, Gas, and Geothermal Resources, and we are working very closely with your local board staff. I first off want to say that Ken Harris, our state oil and gas supervisor, apologizes for not able to be here today. He is working very diligently on the Aliso Canyon project. You may be aware of the gas storage incident, and so he regrettably couldn't be here today. So, secondly, I'd like to commend Matt on his presentation, talking about the collaboration between both the region and the state water board, as well as the Division of Oil and Gas, and our work with the U.S. EPA. It's imperative that we make sure that California's oil operations are in compliance with the Safe Drinking Water Act, and so it's been a collaborative effort, and we're working towards ensuring that for California. So I'm going to talk a little bit about the aquifer exemption process from the division's perspective. When the division, it was pointed out that our interpretation of the boundaries that we used for the aquifer exemptions that were already on the books, failed to meet the Safe Drinking Water Act and the interpretation by the U.S. EPA, the division sprang into action to remedy that and to review and ensure that this didn't happen again. So in part of that process, in our coastal district, which is represented by Santa Cruz, Santa Clara, San Benito, Monterey, San Luis Obispo, Santa Barbara, Ventura, and the northern part of the LA Basin for our coastal district, we went ahead and analyzed that information with regards to what we currently had for injection well inventory. And in doing so, we then were able to prioritize from that list those projects that we thought were important to focus on first. And in doing so, we, Matt talked about the Arroyo Grande project. That's where the water quality is obviously less than 3,000 total dissolved solids, and that was our main focus. We then, once that application was submitted, are focusing on those projects between the 3,000 and the 10,000. So in doing so, we had to communicate with the operators and let them know, and that constant communication we felt was going to ensure the efficiency of this program and the development of these aquifer exemption applications. Now, while the oil companies will bring us information, really that application to the EPA is representative of the state's application. And that's why it's really important for the region, the state board, as well as the Division of Oil and Gas to be in concurrence. Our staff's primary goal is to look at the information that's supplied initially by the operators. Oftentimes, we're the ones giving them the laundry list, so to speak, of the information that we need. They have 3D modeling. They have a lot of different resources that we don't actually have at the district level. And that information, the historical information, so we'd be able to say this is what we need, and then they will supply it. We're verifying the cross-sections, the geologic interpretations, to make sure that they're accurately reflecting what really is going on in the geology. We're also checking over water sampling and so forth. And so that information is then compiled, and as Matt indicated in his report, we then work with our region and the state board and talk about the information that we have. And so really the generation of, or the beginning or infancy of the application starts in the division's district office. It then goes to our headquarters office where we have staff there that review our work. And then if we all concur, then we give it to the state water board and the region to look over as well. And John Robertson and myself have talked about being able to communicate early on so that they have as much time as possible to review the application information. And, of course, if there are any concerns, that comes back to our shop, and we're working with the operator to resolve those issues, to find out what information is needed and can we move forward successfully. So that has taken up quite a bit of our time. That started actually in our office in 2015 and is ongoing. As Matt showed, there are quite a few of the aquifer exemptions. Really, the aquifer exemption process is really taxing for the inland and the coastal districts for the Division of Oil and Gas. We have the primary amount. There isn't any in the southern district, and there's only one in our northern district office. So, as we seem to work through those that are concerned for underground source of drinking water, we'll also then be following behind with those projects that we have ongoing that are non-USDW projects. We'll be going through those and making sure that the water analysis is accurate. Do we need to get a new analysis to make sure that it is, in fact, a non-USDW? And oftentimes there isn't the documentation or concurrence by the water board in those project files. Not to say that we didn't communicate. The division historically would put a notice in the newspaper and send it to our local region, and it was understood that if we didn't receive a comment back, that if they were in concurrence. So, with the transparency and moving forward, we've agreed that it's really important and imperative to have that documentation in those project files. And so we'll be working towards that. And it, sometimes there'll actually be the generation of a document very similar to those requesting an aquifer exemption. There'll be a proposal or application or that sort of same sort of scrutiny for those for non-USDW projects as well. So, that's a lot of what we are doing. And again, Matt talked about the limitations or problems that can be with water sampling. Our Division of Oil and Gas District Office is committed to witnessing the sampling for those zone samples and in ensuring that those are taken from a source that is not contaminated. If there is concerns, then we're going to have to sit down and talk with the water board about that. That's not the only thing that we're doing, though. We're also moving forward as part of our renewal plan in doing project-by-project reviews. We're going through every single one of our injection projects that is active. And in the Orchid office, that's about a little over 80 projects that are active. And we're going through and making sure that all the information that are contained within the injection project is in compliance with our contractual agreement with EPA and also our state and laws and regulations. So we're doing that. about 76 of those operators with those active projects have received letters requesting information. I have a gentleman who's a petroleum engineer from the University of Tulsa who has sent out a checklist of sorts to the operators that says, we've gone through your project. Here's the information that we feel is deficient or needs to be upgraded. So, for instance, if you were an operator who permitted a well in 1995, one injection well, and you had supplied a facilities map, and in 2017 nothing has really changed, there may not be a need for a new updated facilities map. On the other hand, if you had the one injection well permitted in 1995 and now in 2017 you had 100 wells and you had additional injection facilities and we've not received a current map, then that sort of information we're going to want to make sure is updated. So that's been it's a process that we're going through now, and it will be ongoing because not only are we doing the project-by-project review, but part of our oversight of our injection projects is to conduct annual project review meetings. And in doing so, we're going to be ensuring that what the injection volume that's projected for that next year, we're going to ensure that it's within that confined and approved area. And on that topic, that will be a challenge. And it will be, but we'll be asking the operator to supply that information to us. We will be ensuring that those calculations and parameters are correct. And so we will be able to then, in the future, be able to say, oh, in 10 years, we may need to revisit the aquifer exemption currently approved, and we may need to ask for additional area. And confinement is a very big issue. We want to make sure, as Matt pointed out, that it's not only horizontal but vertical. We want to ensure that that water, when it's injected in the ground, we know where it's at. And also part of that is our very rigorous testing program. Our field engineers go out. They're witnessing casing pressure tests. They're witnessing mechanical integrity tests where they're ensuring that fluid is not flowing out the perforations and up behind casing. We're making sure that it is staying within the approved confined zone. It's a big responsibility for our staff. The other activity that the division is undertaking as part of our renewal plan is our commitment to technology. We're spending millions of dollars generating a database that we'll be able to capture all the information and be able to utilize so we can quickly and efficiently know where compliance is needed and be able to support what we're doing in a data format. Also, we're committed to training our personnel. They've just undergone the Top Core program so that they're highly skilled when they're out there witnessing these tests. And we're also in the process of recruiting highly skilled engineers and geologists, chemical engineers, to join our workforce and our team to help with these projects and ensure that we're in compliance and bringing our programs into compliance. So within the coastal district, obviously gas storage is at the forefront. In the coastal district, we have the oldest gas storage facility as well as the largest gas storage facility. So we've got La Galinda, Honor Rancho, and Aliso Canyon. So that is going to have a lot of manpower and testing of those gas storage wells. We also have several offshore features within our coastal district. We have one platform, Platform Holly, and we have Rincon Island. So with that, that's the division and what we're doing, and be happy to answer questions along with Matt.
Thank you, Pat. Just by way of introduction on the topic, if I may, we do not, within our Central Coast region, that's Region 3, we do not have any gas production wells, correct?
You do have some gas injection wells. There are some in the Lompoc Field, some in the gas reinjection in Arroyo Grande. There are some gas reinjection, but as far as a natural gas producing well, no, there wouldn't be any. We used to have Molino Offshore Gas Field off the Santa Barbara coastline, but those wells are plugged and abandoned.
All right. And then my other question, although there are geothermal activities within our central coast, like hot springs, etc., you know, it's DOGGR stands for also geothermal, so I assume you within a region there's no geothermal production facilities. Is that correct?
Well, we've just undergone a reorganization, and so what used to be handled, the geothermal operations by our El Centro office, will in the future be handled out of our coastal district office. There is or was a well, geothermal well, drilled in the long, or, the past Robles area to service the pool. You mentioned hot springs, and I keep threatening that I think as the district deputy, it's imperative for me to go and inspect those facilities, don't you think?
You should go to Avalon, yeah.
That's right.
Sycamore Springs.
Exactly. Anyway, so there are some low-temperature geothermal activity within our area, our district, but very limited. It's not like that of the Salton Sea or the geysers.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you, Pat and Matt, for being here today. Please give my regards to Mr. Harris. What's the difference between containment and confinement? Is there any difference, or are they interchangeable?
I don't think we could use them interchangeably. The term that's used within the state and the federal criteria is containment.
Okay.
Yeah.
So if, after review, agencies agree that a given application deserves exemption for an aquifer because it's well contained, how might earthquakes affect its certainty of containment in the future? I mean, can earthquakes change that reality?
Well, potentially it could if it created a new fracture outside. Much of injection, we understand the overlying layer's maximum allowable pressure at which it would, if it was exerted onto that formation, would cause fracturing, and we ensure that the pressures that are used in an injection well stay adequately below that so that we don't create any fractures. But if there was a major earthquake that would potentially fracture that overlying formation, then you could potentially.
Okay. What's the depth of your typical injection well compared to, like, Salinas Valley groundwater basin? The deep aquifer is somewhere between 900 and 1,800 or 2,000. But are you going 4,000 or 5,000 feet deep for these injection wells?
In the San Arno oil field, where much of the injection is used for enhanced oil recovery, that is within the Lombardi and the Aranac, and that would be on average at about 2,000 feet. Your freshwater aquifer, those that we're finding that are being used for freshwater use for domestic purposes or even agricultural purposes, are at much shallower depth. Above the Poncho Rico. So,
okay. So, if in the next several decades or less, the deep aquifer underused for potable water extraction now is overdrafted, might it be necessary to go to these 2,000 foot aquifers?
You could potentially go down there, but if, for instance, there was no oil extraction, if that was discontinued, then anyone who would drill a well into those zones would, of course, find themselves not just producing water, but would also be producing oil.
Okay, my understanding is that these injection wells are putting water in places that are not necessarily used for oil extraction, but maybe I'm wrong. Is it the case that all of the injection wells were at once or are currently being used for oil extraction?
Well, the majority of the injection wells in the San Auto field, for instance, or even the adjacent McCool Ranch or Lynch Canyon fields, they are used for enhanced oil recovery, so that injection is occurring in the oil-bearing portion of the reservoir. Water disposal, while in that same formations, may be at the edges or the fringes of the zone that's got the oil. So in some instances, we'll call them water disposal, but they do have some water flood effect as well. They're pushing somewhat, the pressure is pushing oil to the producing wells.
Okay. Is there any risk of contamination of the higher aquifers by drilling through them when installing or injecting into the deeper aquifer wells?
If it was drilled as a dirt hole and left uncased, there would be that potential. But the mechanical integrity that is required in drilling the well means that they're using mud to hold back fluids, and then once the well is drilled, they're putting casing or running casing into the well and then putting cement behind in that annular space between the formation and the drilled hole in that casing, so that there really is an avoid there. By having a regulation that requires that there's a certain amount of cement lift or sealing or confinement created by this, it would prevent any sort of fluid injected out the bottom of the well or through a slotted liner to migrate up, because you've got that at least 500 feet of cement in that annular space, as well as a requirement that has at least 100 feet of cement across the saltwater-freshwater interface, which is significantly above. In the San Auto area, I'm going to average that it's about 1,000 feet that we consider where we put the cement for that saltwater-freshwater interface, while your injection interval is a good 1,000 feet below that and has cement. The typical construction for a well, for instance, in the San Auto field, is to bring cement all the way to the surface. So while the shoe of the casing may be at 2,000 feet, the top of the cement behind casing is at the surface.
Okay. The 3,000 to 10,000 range total dissolved solid milligrams per liter that's used for applications, what about those applications that have more than 10,000? Are they also exempt?
They don't need an exemption because they don't need to follow the Safe Drinking Water Act. They're essentially exempt from that.
Okay.
Yeah, they're considered to not be an underground source of drinking water per the federal definition of that.
Okay, so they're the non-U.S.
DW.
Yeah. Okay.
That's correct.
So I know we're talking primarily, I guess, about very near-term economic and technological practicalities. But in the future, let's say beyond the short term, since we're already desalinating waters much higher than 10,000, what is the chance that we may see in the future one of these non-USDW aquifers actually desired as drinking water for desalinization via desal?
Did you ring the first of all, Pat?
Yeah, let me see how to answer that. Actually, one of the benefits, both in the Aurora Grande field and in the San Auto field, is that they both have an RO facility, and they are taking, I know in San Auto they have the capability of taking up to 50,000 barrels a day, processing it, and then taking that fresh water and then putting it into a percolation pond. Actually, it's a pond that they use to kind of get dirty again because it's so fresh, and then it goes into, spills over to a percolation pond, which I think probably has some benefit, and you may have reviewed this project when it was being put forward, to the Salinas River. It's very costly to put in an RO facility, and as part of the aquifer exemption application, a component of that application is to look at the cost to treat the water. And Well, as you point out, Mayor Delgado, it's not inconceivable that that can be done. There is an extreme cost. And I noticed in the earlier item that you reviewed, the individuals from this town of San Arno talked about the cost of fresh water. It would be a very large cost to just simply go in and, as the primary function, install an RO facility. Is it inconceivable? No, it could be conceivable that a project could go in. Just as it may be conceivable that water from the RO facility could be piped to those community residents and as a partnership. But that's outside of our jurisdiction as the Division of Oil and Gas and through this aquifer exemption process.
Okay, thank you. My last question, my understanding through hearing anecdotal statements by other people is that in Price Canyon, in San Luis Obispo, they RO 100% of the wastewater before reinjection. And in San Arno, I've heard different numbers that range between 10 and 25%. And so my first question is, are those statements accurate, that Price Canyon does 100 and San Arno does between 10 and 25?
Well, off the top of my head, I'm not sure on the numbers. I would say a very large portion of the fluid generated in the Rio Grande field goes through the RO facility. In the San Arno field, because of the amount of injection fluid, a large, well, it's 50,000 that goes into potentially the RO facility. A portion of that water does not need to be treated to such an extent, and it can then be have much less treatment and then be turned into steam for reinjection back into the zone where it came from.
And in your mind, when you say a portion, do you think the remaining portion, or do you think a portion of the remaining portion after the RO portion?
There's a smaller portion of what is generated becomes then a very a brine solution that's associated with the RO facility, and that is put into the water disposal wells. Then you've got the part that's the RO, and then so at maximum capacity, and then I would say the greatest portion of that or greatest chunk would be reutilized in the field for generation for the enhanced oil field.
Okay, thank you.
All right.
Thank you, Chair.
Questions? All right. So as we progress with these aquifer exemptions, once exemptions are in place, could perhaps both of you speak a little bit about monitoring, because, you know, once we say, okay, here we are, that's basically beginning of the work, because you're not going to sign off and say, okay, you're good to go, and, you know, maybe we'll visit you in 10 years. So I'd like to hear a little bit, both on the Dogger side, what type of ongoing monitoring, inspection, reporting, and, of course, you know, kind of give me a big summary. And then from your perspective also, Matt, you know, how are we going to monitor these facilities for full compliance with, you know, the aquifer exemptions?
Chair Wolf, thank you for bringing that up. Well, the aquifer exemption process is to allow approval within an area, a boundary. It does not approve the drilling or injection into a well. That is another step. And so whether you're establishing a new project or expanding an existing project or reactivating a project, that application or that proposal needs to come to the Division of Oil and Gas. And as we start to review that, we will be working with the region to go ahead and say, here's what the proposal is. They want to put in so many additional wells, and this is the anticipated volume of injection over the life of the project. And so we will look at those. And while they talk about a conditional approval in the aquifer exemption process, part of those really go back to operational constraints. And we don't want to base solely the approval of an aquifer exemption on operational constraints. But we have the ability to put those in as we permit the wells and the project. So if you needed a monitoring well to monitor a reservoir's temperature, we can discuss that between the region and the state board and the division and determine how many of those wells would be necessary and where we would recommend their placement. Pressure observation wells, the total volume that they could potentially inject. Those are all operational constraints that becomes part of the project approval process. And in that process, it's not just between us. If it's a large expansion, we're putting a notice in the newspaper and accepting comment from interested parties. Operators are also required to notify their adjacent oil operators because it may affect them. And so the division, as well as the water board, would be receiving those comments and considering them as we're developing operational constraints. Then, as I mentioned, the annual review process, we're going to be maintaining what we call a project approval letter and making sure that the operator is going by those conditions that we set forth, those operational constraints. We're going to make sure that they're in compliance. And as part of that, that's when our field engineers go out and ensure that the injection water is being confined to the zone. Are those wells, are they in good mechanical integrity? Do we need to run a USIT log to talk about metal thickness in the casing? Is there, you know, the need for a tubing and packer? Those sorts of operational constraints, we're going to be ensuring not only in the letter, but that they're occurring in the field, and we'll be annually reviewing those with the operator. Matt?
So I kind of just rephrase what Pat was saying, that in many instances, they're already requiring, you know, operational controls and monitoring, or the operators themselves are implementing monitoring, such as, you know, pressure, so they could look at gradients, temperature, if it's steam injection, they can see what the influence of that steam is, how far it goes out. In many cases, those existing controls and conditions are effective. In some cases, I think it may be appropriate to expand on them. Our focus has been looking at the potential for applying water quality-related type monitoring for various constituents. It would be starting with total dissolved solids or any other constituents that may be within the injected fluids or the formation where they're injecting itself relative to what's outside in the areas that we're starting to look at, you know, that we want to protect. You know, as you may know, is an outcome of Senate Bill 4, the hydraulic fracking bill. The State Water Board developed a fairly extensive water quality monitoring program for hydraulic fracturing wells, so projects that are actually injecting chemicals under high pressure for, you know, the purposes of fracking. It's not the same as what you see in the Midwest or back east. In one of the conversations that we have repeatedly with our State Water Board counterparts is that it would probably be very useful, and we should be applying that same monitoring to just injection in general, not just hydraulic fracking. But this time, what we're trying to do is provide recommendations where we think water quality monitoring or, you know, century well type monitoring would be appropriate to confirm compliance with the containment criteria.
So the installation of monitoring wells is can only be implemented through a recommendation. It cannot be conditional as part of the say, the aquifer exemption permit?
The operational constraints would come afterwards because, as I said, the ability to have approval to inject into a shaded area or into a within a boundary does not give you the authority to drill a well in there and begin injection. They then go, that's like phase one. Then the step two is now I have to establish a project if one hasn't been established, or if I have an established project and I'm going to introduce wells into that, well then, for instance, in the case of a Rio Grande, prime example of a desire to add, I think it's in phase five, they talk about adding some 300 or so wells. Many of those would be cyclic steam wells, so those are injection wells. While they are producing wells, they do have to inject some steam out there and then produce the oil back. That would then be an expansion of their existing project, in which case we'd put a notice in the newspaper. We would be looking at where these wells are going to be strategically placed within the field, and we could be introducing. And on the past project approval letter, we did have some information about Sentinel wells for getting information, and we would be looking at that again. We've already been in discussions with the regional board on potentially adding some conditions, and those are in their project approval letter. It essentially is, if you want to inject, you have to follow the conditions listed in the project approval letter. Failure to do so would mean then that you jeopardize your authority to inject. And you mentioned about me and my crystal ball, and could we use that? And one of the things that I forgot is that, as I sat here listening to Matt, I recalled that while we talk about salts, there are also other constituents in those formations. And we do have high levels of boron in some of these formations that are naturally occurring. And so those are just other things that would drive up the cost should a municipality want to go in and make improvements to that water.
So if I could add, so using the Arroyo Grande field as an example, the cost of their water, I think, is currently about $50,000 an acre foot, which is far above the running cost of water. So, you know, it becomes an economics issue in answer to your question, Mr. Delgado, of at what point does it become economical or make economic sense to use that water as a water source rather than see it as a waste? And it more, that cost gap is quite large right now. $50,000 an acre foot, yeah. Yeah, that's pretty pronounced. Also, if I could, I just want to do a time check right now because in theory we're supposed to be out of here by 5, and we still have one more item and one more presentation to go. And we can go either way, but I just want to have a decision point.
I look at my left, my right, no additional question. So, Pat, thank you so much for joining us from Orcutt.
Thank you. Thank you so much for the invitation. Look forward to future meetings with the board.
And Matt, thank you for a nice, comprehensive summary, distilling down to a few slides, a very complex topic. You did a good job. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome. So,